Picture a crisp evening in 1995. You're sitting inside this bustling French restaurant in New York City. The champagne is flowing.
Sounds like a pretty good night.
Right. And at the table with you is a team of brilliant scientists from Bell Labs, right alongside these corporate executives who flew in just for this. They're toasting to what is, by all accounts, a total technological miracle.
Yeah, they had just successfully deployed a machine called the HCAR50.
Exactly. So, welcome to this deep dive where we are exploring the book Jan LeCun, Father of Artificial Intelligence, specifically focusing on Part 3, Chapter 5.
Which is titled The Twilight of Bell Labs.
That's the one. Our mission today is to explore what happens when a monumental technological success is just instantly dismantled, triggering a massive AI winter, and how a few really stubborn pioneers survived by just, waiting for the world to catch up.
It's just such a profound irony to start with that specific scene. I mean,
Yeah.
that triumphant dinner, that moment of absolute vindication for an engineering team that had labored for years to build this machine.
Because it happened on the exact same day their project was functionally destroyed.
Right. And let's set the stage a bit to understand the scale of what was lost here. This team worked at the Bell Labs Holmdel facility.
Oh, that place was legendary. It was this giant glass box designed by Eero Saarinen, sitting right in the middle of a New Jersey field reflecting the sky.
Yeah, thousands of scientists worked inside. And in one of those departments, Jan LeCun and his colleagues birthed this check reading machine, the HCR50. It was powered by a convolutional neural network, or CNN.
And it was already sitting in the back offices of US banks, right?
Yeah.
Just autonomously reading up to 20% of all the handwritten checks in the country.
20%, it's staggering. And what stands out in the sources is the mechanical elegance of how the HCR50 actually worked. It didn't demand absolute perfection.
Right. The neural network wasn't just guessing a number, it was designed to calculate a probability distribution and score its own confidence.
That is a crucial distinction. When it looked at a handwritten check, it didn't just output this is a seven, it output a mathematical certainty like, I am 99% sure this is a seven.
And if the ink was clear and the confidence was high, the machine just processed the transaction autonomously.
Exactly. But if the handwriting was erratic, say it was split 50-40 on whether a sloppy squiggle was a seven or a one, the machine had a hard-coded threshold.
Meaning low confidence meant it immediately flagged that specific check and just handed it over to human eyes.
Right. It was not designed to replace human workers entirely. It was designed to reduce the literal mountains of paper they had to sift through.
And it was handling tens of millions of checks. I mean, this was not a lab simulation. Real money was moving based on the statistical weights of a neural network.
Which completely proves this technology was robust infrastructure, not just some academic toy.
So they're at the French restaurant celebrating all of this. And then comes the corporate shockwave. On September 20, 1995, AT&T announces it is splitting into three separate entities.
Yeah, AT&T for telecommunications, Lucent for equipment and research, and NCR for computers and terminals.
And suddenly, this unified team of scientists is just scattered across completely different corporate organizational charts.
The human alignment was shattered overnight. And the legal division of the intellectual property was even more chaotic.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the tragedy of the patents here is almost difficult to believe. You have AT&T lawyers dividing up the assets,
Yeah.
and in their infinite wisdom, as LeCun later joked, they gave the core patents for convolutional neural networks to NCR.
A company that primarily made cash registers and financial terminals.
Right, they had absolutely no idea what to do with a neural network.
None. So the people who actually understood the math, the ones who wanted to push the research forward, were left in one organization. Meanwhile, the legal right to use and profit from that technology was locked away in the financial ledgers of a company that didn't understand it.
Wait, hold on. If the engineers who built it couldn't freely use their own creation, how long did those patents just sit there?
They sat completely unused until they naturally expired, which was around 2007.
Wow. Which, ironically, is exactly when the world's internet data and computer processing power had finally grown enough for neural networks to become dominant again. That is an incredible coincidence.
It really is. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, this wasn't just a clumsy corporate reshuffle, was it?
No, it marked the end of a very specific era in American innovation. For decades, massive monopolies like the phone company essentially functioned like governments.
Right. They heavily subsidized pure foundational science that didn't need to turn an immediate profit. I mean, the transistor, information theory, the laser, these were all born from that exact environment.
But when AT&T was broken up, those resulting companies were forced to compete ruthlessly on quarterly earnings. Research just became viewed as a mere expense. The twilight of Bell Labs was really the sun setting on corporate-funded pure science.
And while the physical lab was being dismantled from the outside by all these corporate lawyers, there was a fierce theoretical battle happening right inside its hallways.
Oh, yeah. Right next door to Lutun's office was a Soviet-born mathematician named Vladimir Vapnik.
And Vapnik is a towering figure in this field. He's widely considered the father of statistical learning theory.
He had spent decades in Moscow refining his theories before coming to the U.S. after the Cold War. And he and LeCun literally worked on the same floor, separated by a single wall.
Under the exact same department head, Larry Jackall. And their worldviews could not have been more fundamentally opposed.
Vapnik championed a method called support vector machines, or SVMs. He believed in rigorous mathematical guarantees.
Right. His philosophy was based on something called structural risk minimization. To him, if you couldn't mathematically prove the absolute limits of your machine, well, it wasn't science.
But LeCun, on the other hand, favored empirical risk minimization. He was an engineer at heart. His approach was basically build it, let it run, see if it minimizes errors on the data, and we'll just figure out the underlying formal proof later.
To truly understand their divide, we really need to look at how these two methods navigate problem solving. Let's look at the mechanism of Vapnik's support vector machines first.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So imagine you have a map, and you want to separate all the houses from all the commercial buildings. An SVM essentially tries to draw a line between those two groups of data.
But it doesn't just draw any line, right?
Exactly. It calculates the widest possible street that can fit between them without touching a building. That street provides a mathematical margin of safety.
And Vapnik could mathematically prove that his algorithm would always find the absolute widest street.
Yes. And because of that proof, there is a guaranteed predictable answer.
The book provides another great visual for this optimization landscape. Think of Vapnik's SVMs as a smooth, perfectly symmetrical bowl. No matter where you drop a marble into that bowl, it will always roll down to the exact same bottom.
Right. You get a single guaranteed answer every single time you run the data. But LeCun's neural networks were entirely different.
Yeah, the optimization landscape for a neural network is not a smooth bowl. It is a jagged, multidimensional mountain range.
You drop a marble, which represents your starting parameters, and it just bounces around chaotically. You have no mathematical guarantee which valley it will ultimately land in.
Or if the valley it settles in is even the lowest valley in the entire mountain range.
And to a theorist like Vapnik, relying on a machine that settles into an unpredictable valley was just totally unacceptable.
Let me push back on Vapnik's mindset for a second, though. Vapnik sat one office over from LeCun. He saw the HDR50 working with his own eyes.
He did.
He saw a machine clearing millions of real-world bank checks, finding a highly useful valley in that mountain range every single day. Why did he dig his heels in? Wouldn't seeing a machine clear millions of dollars instantly end the theoretical debate?
What's fascinating here is that given the constraints of the 1995 environment, Vapnik was objectively right. You have to remember, data sets back then were tiny.
Like maybe a few thousand examples.
Exactly. And computers were just agonizingly slow. In that environment, neural networks frequently did get stuck in the wrong valleys. Their learning signals would just fade out before they even finished training.
Ah, okay. Whereas SVMs were incredibly robust on small data.
More importantly, Vapnik had a comprehensive theory for generalization.
Right, generalization. Yeah. That's the machine's ability to guess correctly on raw data it has never seen before, rather than just memorizing the flashcards it used for training.
Precisely. If a neural network has millions of parameters, but is only trained on a few thousand images, Vapnik's math strongly suggested it should just memorize the data overfit, in technical terms, and fail completely in the real world.
So Vapnik's theory of structural risk minimization demanded that you limit the complexity of your model to prevent that memorization. And LeCun's massive networks just completely violated that mathematical rule.
They broke the rules entirely.
So how do you settle a debate where the theory says the machine shouldn't work, but the engineering proves it sometimes does?
Well, you do it with data. You do it with a bet.
LeCun actually curated a highly specific data set to stress test these systems side by side. He took handwriting samples from the National Institute of Standards and Technology and created a perfectly formatted data set.
Yes, 60,000 training images and 10,000 testing images of handwritten numbers. It became known as MNIST.
And MNIST is legendary in the field. It basically became the fruit fly of machine learning.
That's a great analogy. Just as biologists use fruit flies to test genetics because they are simple and well understood, AI researchers used MNIST as the baseline test.
If you had a new algorithm, you tested it on MNIST first to see how it performed against standard handwriting.
And what I find refreshing is that despite their massive philosophical disagreements, the culture at Holmdel was so deeply collaborative that LeCun and Vapnik co-authored a paper together in 1995.
They actually ran both their methods on MNIST, and the results were razor close. SVMs were incredibly strong, just as Vapnik predicted, but the neural networks held their own without memorizing the data.
But the real drama was the wager made in Larry Jackall's office, a wager documented on two sheets of paper.
Tell us about the bet.
Larry Jackall, their boss, bet Vapnik, a fancy dinner, that by the year 2000, someone would mathematically prove why large neural networks generalize so well.
And Vapnik, in return, bet Jackall a dinner that by the year 2005, no one in their right mind would still be using 1995-style neural networks.
And LeCun actually signed both pieces of paper as the official witness.
The ultimate showdown between theory and engineering, so who actually won?
That is the beautiful paradox of this whole story. They both won, and they both lost.
Wait, how does that work?
Well, Vapnik won his bet because the year 2000 came and went, and no unified mathematical proof ever arrived to explain neural network generalization. But Jackall won his bet because in 2005, people were absolutely still using neural networks.
And this highlights a profound, lingering mystery. Even today, in our current era where giant AI models are everywhere, the math hasn't fully caught up.
It hasn't. We still do not have a perfect, airtight mathematical theory explaining exactly why massive neural networks generalize so beautifully instead of just memorizing their training data.
So Vapnik's question wasn't wrong. The mathematical answer is just taking decades to arrive.
But the academic world of the late 1990s couldn't wait decades for that answer. And this brings us to the second AI winter, running roughly from 1995 to 2002.
It's important to clarify, though, that this winter wasn't caused by a mathematical proof showing neural nets were impossible.
No, not at all. It was caused by a shift in what the academic community considered to be legitimate scientific inquiry.
The prevailing dogma of the time was all about hand-coded features. If you were a computer vision researcher in 1998, you were expected to write mathematical rules for detecting the edge of an object or, you know, the curve of a shape.
You'd use complex math, like Gabor filters, to explicitly tell the computer what to look for. The machine's only job was to do the final sorting based on the human's rules.
Because if a human mathematician wrote the rule, the process was transparent. The idea that a machine could look at raw pixels and independently learn its own features through a neural network was viewed as a black box.
To the academic establishment, it was lazy, it was uninterpretable, and therefore, it was simply not science.
There is a brutal quote in the sources that perfectly captures this hostility. LeCun's team submitted a paper to CVPR, which is one of the premier computer vision conferences.
And the rejection letter didn't just critique their results.
No, it actually read, "This paper tells us nothing about computer vision because all the features and rules are just learned by the machine."
Unbelievable. Because the machine learned the features independently, without a human explicitly defining them, the reviewers dismissed it entirely. If you couldn't explain the rule the machine found, it was just treated as a mathematical fluke.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. LeCun's reaction to this is telling. He didn't bend to the criticism or try to dress his work up in traditional hand-coded math to appease the reviewers.
No, he questioned their entire measuring stick.
Yeah.
He pointed out that trying to build AI by hand-coding every human rule was like trying to build an airplane by perfectly copying a bird's feathers and flapping motion.
Right. The early aviation pioneers who tried to copy feathers failed. The ones who succeeded were the ones who discovered the underlying mathematical principle of aerodynamics lift.
LeCun believed his neural networks weren't blindly copying the biological brain. They were leveraging the underlying mathematical principles of how learning actually happens.
It is a phenomenal point about the history of engineering. The steam engine was powering locomotives long before the laws of thermodynamics were formalized. Airplanes flew before aerodynamics was fully understood as a strict science.
Function often precedes theory. The tragedy of the late 90s academic establishment was their refusal to accept that historical sequence.
And the human cost of this AI winter was severe. If you've ever proposed a project at work that got killed just because it didn't fit standard operating procedure, you know exactly what LeCun's colleagues were facing.
Joshua Bengio, a close collaborator of LeCun's who had moved to Montreal, talked about how he had to essentially twist the arms of his smartest students just to get them to study neural networks.
Because it was viewed as career suicide. To put the phrase neural network in a grant proposal meant you automatically lost your funding.
The true darkness of this winter wasn't just an intellectual debate over empirical versus structural risk. It was active academic exclusion. It forces you to consider how often in our own fields we reject a tool that clearly works, simply because it doesn't fit our current rigid definition of what the process should look like.
So to survive this exclusion, LeCun and his remaining team at AT&T had to get incredibly creative. They took a detour and built a tool called DJVu.
Yeah, DJVu was an image compression format designed for scanned documents, and it was revolutionary for the slow dial-up internet of the time.
The mechanism behind DJVu was brilliant. It essentially taught the computer to act like a strict bouncer at a club, separating the data into two distinct layers.
Right, so the algorithm looked for sharp, high-contrast edges, that's the text layer, and sent those to one highly compressed, crisp file.
And then it took all the soft, blurry background colors, the paper texture, the stains, and sent them to a separate, lower-resolution file. By separating the clustering math used for sharp edges from the math used for soft gradients, the file size just plummeted without losing readability.
And it was incredibly practical. DGVu actually became the backbone format for the Internet Archive, helping digitize vast amounts of human knowledge.
And crucially, LeCun's team released the viewing software for free and eventually open-sourced the code. It was a way of keeping the team's engineering skills sharp and proving their value while their primary passion, neural networks, was treated as heresy.
It also reveals LeCun's fundamental mindset. Good tools change the world faster when they're shared openly rather than locked away in corporate vaults.
A stark contrast to how NCR handled those CNN patents. But even that sanctuary at the corporate lab couldn't last forever. The early 2000s hit and the dot-com bubble bursts.
The telecommunications industry crashes entirely. AT&T and Lucent are decimated by the market. That beautiful glass box and home bill just empties out.
The corporate research era is truly over. LeCun leaves in 2002. He goes to the NEC Research Lab in Princeton for a bit, where, amazingly, he crosses paths with Vapnik again.
It's a deeply poignant moment in the text. The engineer and the theorist, both pushed out of the collapsing corporate monopoly, sheltering under the same roof once again.
It proved that the shifting economic tide spared no one, regardless of which mathematical theory they backed.
Exactly. Finally, in 2003, LeCun takes a professorship at New York University's Current Institute. He moves to Manhattan.
He has to start completely over, find students, fight for grants in a skeptical environment, but he has one crucial asset. He practiced what we might call calculated patience.
Right. He had a specific calculated thesis about the future. He knew that computer processing power was doubling every few years, adhering to Moore's law.
He also knew that the internet was accumulating massive troves of digital data. The two physical bottlenecks that held his neural networks back in 1995, slow compute and small data sets, were problems that time was actively solving for him.
Conversely, the hand-coded feature methods preferred by his academic critics were going to hit a wall. Human labor simply couldn't scale to mathematically define every feature in an exploding ocean of data.
So what does this all mean for you? Well, it's deeply relevant to anyone navigating a long-term career goal. Sometimes you aren't wrong. Your idea isn't flawed. The environment just isn't ready for you yet.
LeCun wasn't just being stubborn for the sake of it. He was observing the structural trends of hardware and data and realized he just needed to outlast the skeptics.
The university environment provided the one resource the corporate world no longer could time. Time insulated from quarterly earnings reports.
It allowed the seeds of his research to stay buried in the cold earth, safe until the technological climate was finally ready for them to sprout.
And when spring finally came, the vindication was absolute. By 2012, neural networks demolished hand-coded methods in computer vision. In 2019, Jan LeCun, Joshua Bengio, and Jeffrey Hinton were awarded the Turing Award, the Nobel Prize of Computing.
And the committee didn't just cite their technical breakthroughs in deep learning. They specifically cited their ability to endure that long winter and stand by their convictions when the rest of the scientific community had turned its back.
Which is an incredible way to end that chapter of his life.
It is. This raises an important question, though, and it's a fascinating irony hidden at the end of the text. Back during that AI winter in the 90s, Vapnik argued that crunching massive amounts of data with brute force computing wasn't true intelligence.
Right. He pointed out that human children learn complex concepts from just a few examples, not millions of flashcards.
Exactly. But today, as we watch the explosion of large language models, Jan LeCun is making that exact same critique.
Wait, really? The guy who relied on massive data to beat Vapnik's theories is now using Vapnik's argument?
Yes. LeCun argues that LLMs reading the entire internet and predicting the next word of text is not the same as a child truly understanding the physical world through observation. He insists that true artificial intelligence will need to learn efficiently from far less data, just like a human does.
The engineer who championed big data is now echoing the old theorist next door. It makes you wonder, are the skeptics of our past actually predicting the limitations of our future? It's something for you to mull over as we watch the current AI boom unfold. Just remember that 1995 dinner party, the glass box reflecting the New Jersey sky, and the calculated patience it takes to let an idea truly take flight. Until next time, keep digging beneath the surface.